Monroe County schools have set up a task force to decide how to get kids back to the classroom. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. That task force has to figure out how to bring students back in the fall and keep them safe. Will that mean social distancing in classrooms? We're talking with Superintendent Mark Porter, and we're taking your calls. Also, there's a lot of debate about antibody testing and its effectiveness. The governor and other politicians have pushed these forms of tests despite a lack of accuracy. What information can we take from antibody tests? Can they tell us whether we are immune to the virus? Finally, restaurants are reopened, but with a lot of restrictions. We're going to look at one of the largest industries in South Florida and whether eateries can survive the pandemic.
It's going to be a lot of opportunity for people who want to open restaurants and a lot of bad things for people who own them already.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, this Friday marks the final day for graduating seniors in the Florida Keys. But like millions of their peers across the country, they won't be celebrating with their friends. They're going to be doing it from video calls, maybe from their couch. Over the past several weeks, we've been speaking with educational leaders across our four counties about the future of schooling during the pandemic. Today, we head down to Key West to speak with Monroe County Superintendent Mark Porter. And if you live in the Keys, what questions do you have about plans for the summer, plans for the fall? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN, or find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Mr. Porter joins us now. Superintendent Porter, great to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be with you this afternoon.
So let me start with this. You're leaving, you're retiring after, I think it's 8 years now, right?
Yes, I will be completing my 8th year here in the Monroe County Schools back in 2012. I was actually the first school board appointed superintendent here in Monroe County, and I had my contract renewed a couple of times, and then it just seemed long prior to the COVID pandemic, it just seemed like the right time for me to move on, and so I'll be departing the Keys here at the end of July.
Well, I guess, I mean, first, congratulations on your time here and what you've done and on the retirement and looking forward to what comes next. But having said that, let me ask you, you're leaving now, and you didn't know this before you made this decision, but you're leaving now when the district is facing maybe its greatest challenge. I mean, what do you think about when you think about that?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm comforted by the fact that the school board has already named a successor superintendent, and Mrs. Terry Axford, who is a part of my leadership team. She's been our executive director of teaching and learning. And in fact, earlier today, we had a large task force meeting convened by Mrs. Axford that was all about Back to School 2020. So we're already kind of jumping on board with what needs to happen before we can bring kids back next fall. And Mrs. Axford is guiding that effort. So it'll be a very smooth succession and transition, despite the great challenges that will present themselves when we get to the fall of 2020.
And what role do you play in that transition of power?
You know, to be honest, I think it's supportive. That's my role. I think I need to be here to support whatever it is that she feels that she might need. There are certain roles and responsibilities that can't be delegated, so to speak, from the sitting superintendent. So I need to kind of continue to fulfill those roles. But over the coming weeks, my job, I think, will be to make things as smooth, as easy, and you know, as seamless as we possibly can. And I think it's a huge advantage that we have here in the Monroe County Schools that, despite this great challenge, we at least have the opportunity to make it as smooth and easy as possible.
Let me go back to when this pandemic, just before the pandemic was announced, and then all of a sudden you started hearing conversations about shutdowns and everybody had to stay at home. But when it was announced by the World Health Organization, what were the conversations within the school district, and when and how did you decide, okay, everybody go home?
Well, first of all, you know, as soon as we started to see the pandemic, and, you know, certainly we did not predict, you know, exactly where it was going to go, but we did immediately initiate some internal conversation and planning about online learning. And one thing I think that we were very fortunate with here in Monroe County is that we have heavily invested in technology over the past several years, and that's been supported by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax that is used in part for those purposes. So we had the devices in hand, and we had a lot of our teachers and students who were fairly adept at using technology as part of their learning platform. Now, not exclusively technology-driven, but at least they were quite familiar with the tools that were available to them. Then it really wasn't our choice necessarily to shut down. It really came from Tallahassee that all schools were going to be closed. Initially, we were to stay out, obviously, for our scheduled spring break, and then they asked us to remain out of school for one additional week. And so we immediately used that time to put our plan together and get ready to deploy that plan. And sure enough, we did not come back to school, as some might have thought, after those 2 weeks, but instead have remained out of school ever since about the middle of March. But our transition to online learning was challenging. It required a great deal of effort on the part of our teachers, on the part of our students, and I would say on the part of our parents as well. But we were very well prepared, again, in terms of the technology that we had available to us, in the fact that most of our teachers and students, again, were quite familiar with the use of technology.
And I want to ask you about how they're doing with distance learning. But again, just a reminder, we're talking with Monroe County School Superintendent Mark Porter. And if you live in the Keys, you have a question about what's going to happen in the fall, for example. Now, he is retiring, but still, we want to ask that question. We want to find out what is the school board thinking right now in preparing for the fall. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. You can always find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. All right, so Mr. Porter, the Keys in this very unique position, compared to the rest of South Florida. You had a lot fewer. You still have a lot fewer cases of coronavirus compared to Miami-Dade and Broward. Did that make the approach, to the issue of school closures any different? I know, of course, the Keys have been closed off to everybody. So, but I mean, again, because of the situation in the Keys and you didn't have so many cases, has that shaped the way you're thinking about how to handle this?
I don't think it did. I think we responded as I think all of the CDC guidelines and recommendations and so forth indicated that we should. And I think that has also contributed in part to the fact that we, to this point, have been able to kind of pretty well manage the whole outbreak of COVID-19. Of course, we're all awaiting what happens when those checkpoints come down on Monday, June 1st, and we see what we anticipate will be an influx of people from other parts of the mainland. But we really didn't change our approach versus others. We stuck to the book, so to speak, stuck to the guidelines, and I think it really helped us, make sure that this thing did not spread and allowed us to implement our online learning pretty effectively. We've been very minimally impacted. I think maybe we've had one or two employees is all that I've been informed about who at some point did contract COVID.
Yes.
But that's a pretty minimal outbreak.
And you know what? You bring that up, and I wanted to ask about this because it may be a glimpse as to how schools everywhere are going to have to handle the situation. You had one employee that tested positive, and they were working on the campus, but obviously, there are no students there. And then you had to have that employee and numerous others self-quarantine, and then there had to be a deep clean of the school. This happened on Sugarloaf Key. Do you think that's a glimpse of what could happen if we reopen schools in the fall? One person gets it, and all of a sudden, everything's got to be shut down, deep clean, lots of self-quarantine?
I think it is a little bit of foreshadowing. I think the tricky part will be that each and every situation will have to be assessed on kind of an individual basis. I will acknowledge that this particular employee had been somewhat mobile about the school building, so we did have an impact with a few other employees who had contact, and as you just accurately indicated, they were put into a self-quarantine for 14 days. So one of the things that we have asked of our employees when they do come back into our buildings, and they have been allowed to do so on a very limited basis, is we generally have asked them to make a very minimal amount of movement, throughout the building. It's kind of come in the door, go to your destination, and return by the same path, so to speak.
But you,
and some of that,
you,
go ahead.
You went, but you did basically contact tracing. You had to figure out everybody that person came into contact with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly the protocol that the Department of Health, they really take over when you have this identified case and that you then cooperate and work with them. And so we did have to do the contact tracing. But I think it's something we're going to have to keep in mind when we do bring people back, is that, you know, we're not quite as free to roam perhaps as much as we had in the past, because, again, what we had to do here was we had to clean those areas that this individual employee had had passed through for whatever reason. And the more we can limit some of that, I think, you know, the less disruptive, you know, any type of an outbreak, you know, might be. Because at some point, you certainly will be faced with the possibility of having to shut down an entire school. But I think initially, I think it'll be more of a partial, you know, kind of a cleaning, a partial shutdown. And so these are just the kind of things we're going to have to kind of figure out how to deal with come the fall of 2020.
And how did you guys find out that employee had tested positive?
This employee self-reported.
Okay.
And that, of course, would be an expectation that we would have of all of our employees under these you know, under these circumstances. And again, during the time they were in the building, they were asymptomatic, but you know, subsequently started to develop symptoms and then immediately had themselves tested. So again, you know, even though we had the one situation, I think it was you know, very well contained, and a good opportunity for us, so to speak, to practice some protocols and practices that we may have to employ in the fall.
Again, talking with Monroe County School Superintendent Mark Porter, interesting point there about, you know, getting tested and then, of course, self-reporting and, you know, coming up for the fall, we're all trying to figure out if we're going to open the schools up and bring kids back to the campus, how should that be handled? Should kids be tested all the time and checked all the time? And, of course, if you're a parent, what are your thoughts on this? What should happen when we get to the fall? Should we just keep kids at home? Can we let them get back to campus? We'd like to hear your thoughts. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Superintendent, you said that, you know, the teachers and the students, they were pretty up on the technology and they were ready for this. But what have you heard from teachers and parents about how they're handling this distance learning right now?
I can tell you what we hear, generally speaking, is it's been quite stressful, maybe in part because it was so abrupt and so, you know, kind of unplanned for and unexpected. But that's one of the first things that we started to hear, was that it was very stressful on students, on parents, on teachers as well. And I think one of the situations, it took us a while, I think, to kind of adjust and modify our expectations of how online learning would flow, so to speak, as compared to face-to-face learning. And I think to begin with, to be honest, and we kept telling our teachers this somewhat repeatedly, we were trying to do too much. And I think we were placing a lot of additional stress on teachers and students, and again, indirectly on parents, because we were trying to make too much happen too fast. And gradually over time, I think we were able to adjust our expectations, and I think we've had a much smoother ride, so to speak, during the, you know, the latter portions of the month of May than we did in the first few weeks in April.
And one of the things, too, about your school district is that, you know, I mean, look, it's significantly smaller than, of course, you know, Miami-Dade, Broward, or Palm Beach County, but slightly less than half of your district is considered economically disadvantaged. That's from the Department of Education. What's been the process of getting these kids food? Because when school was in, they had their meals. What's been the challenge of making sure we're still feeding these kids?
I tell you what, all I can do is really give a huge shout out to our Director of Food Services, Mr. Jim Fagioni, in partnership with our Transportation Director, Mr. Randy Fabel. These two gentlemen stepped in and really made it happen. We've been delivering approximately 1,500 meals every day, and on Fridays we deliver multiple meals to be used over the weekend. And so, you know, these people stepped up and really made sure that our kids were continuing to get fed. And we also have, we do have a small cadre of social workers and, of course, guidance counselors. And these people became critical links, you know, to some of our families in terms of getting them the information that they needed, to know that there were meals available to them, getting them the information they needed in terms of getting devices picked up. And also trying to help them with some of the internet connectivity. We've had some generosity in the community step up to try to purchase some Wi-Fi hotspots, because we still have some kids located in regions that do not have reliable internet access. And so some of this is actually still an ongoing effort, because as we approach summer school, our initial efforts at summer school in the month of June will continue to be delivered in an online format. But the the food distribution, I think, has been really a remarkable story, and it's the efforts of two gentlemen who really lead those efforts, but also a group of employees who were really committed and willing to step up and make that food delivery happen, despite the fact that they were, in some ways, you know, exposing themselves to some small additional risk to be out in the public in the way that they were. But they were very committed to their students to make sure that they were being well fed during this difficult time.
I want to come back to this task force that is now working to get ready for the fall. And this is the challenge school districts around the country are trying to figure out, is what's going to happen? Are we going to be able to bring everybody back to campus? And then if we do, how different will things be? So again, you know, you have a successor, an interim successor, who's already getting ready for that, for the job. But what can you tell us about what this task force is trying to figure out and what the fall is going to look like?
Well, I think they're trying to figure out everything you've mentioned and a whole lot more. I mean, it's a somewhat daunting task. It's a very much of an unknown. The task force consists of slightly over 50 stakeholders, both from within the district and across the community, representing a wide variety of interests and perspectives. And it's been broken down, and I think it's five separate subcommittees or committees of that task force to try to look at some specific, you know, kind of areas of concern. Because I don't think there's going to be one certainly simple answer to any of this. I don't think all kids are going to automatically just come back to school in a normal way, nor do I believe that all kids will be staying home for online learning. I think it'll, again, be some type of a hybrid model of that. One of the challenges we, of course, have is as long as social distancing is with us, and I think it's going to continue to be with us for a while.
Well, what do you think that's going to look like, though? Because you think about a classroom, and you're putting 20 to 30 kids in a classroom. I know that one of the conversations is, well, no more lunch in the lunchroom because you can't have big crowds. What's going to happen, for example, like in classrooms, the public restrooms, PE class, sports, after-school activities? What do you think is going to happen with all these?
Well, first of all, in the classroom environment, I think you may not have all the kids in the classroom at the same time. You will probably need to utilize whatever space you have available in that building on an ongoing basis. In other words, you won't be able to leave large spaces vacant, you know, for periods of time. So in other words, your cafeteria spaces will probably be used differently during the year, as you just mentioned, probably not going to be used necessarily for the large scale, you know, lunchroom activities. You're probably going to serve lunches in the classroom, but you may then repurpose some of your large spaces, such as lunchrooms, gymnasiums, those types of things, for use throughout the day, so that you again are dispersing students as best you can. I think the one that you probably didn't mention that we think is going to be perhaps the most challenging, and that is school buses. How do you get kids to school? And of course, with our school spread out over 106 miles, busing is absolutely essential to many of our students in order for them to be able to get to school. So that's the one we're actually kind of wrestling with the most at the moment is how do you accomplish any type of social distancing on a school bus? And what do you do with the overall capacity?
Does that mean that you're going to have to get more buses?
Well, you know, I got to be honest with you. We're fortunate enough here where we would have the resources for more buses. Our bigger challenge is more drivers. It's not a highly paid profession, and I think everywhere people are struggling for more drivers. So I don't know if the answer is simple. There's more buses. I think you might have to get somewhat more creative in terms of how you run your bus routes. But one of our big partners in this whole thing is going to be the local health department, and having them help us in assessing kind of what's the risk level of some of these alternatives that we are considering. And at some point, you just have to kind of come to grips with what you might call an acceptable risk in order to make some of these things happen. I don't think we can move forward and try to keep ourselves in what I would call a zero-risk environment and still be able to educate kids effectively.
I mean, you're going through this pandemic, but, you know, I think about the fact that it wasn't that long ago when Hurricane Irma hit and, you know, the Category 4 storm in 2017. Are Monroe schools fully recovered from that?
I think our schools are perhaps better recovered from that than some portions of our community. You know, I have to be honest, you know, we were back in school. I still have these numbers in my head, 13, 15, and 18 days of missed school after Hurricane Irma, which I thought was a pretty aggressive plan to get kids back in school. But our communities really wanted our kids back in school. The schools we build are not built cheaply, but they did hold up extremely well. And so we were able to really get things back in order. So I think our schools have recovered. I'm sure there's still some of our staff members who are struggling with some of the after effects of Hurricane Irma, and to be honest, some of our families. But there's even a greater part of our community in terms of some of the housing stock and some other things that are still in a recovery mode. And so the pandemic now, and of course on Monday we'll enter the official, you know, hurricane season, definitely a cause for great concern in Monroe County.
Well, and sticking with Hurricane Irma recovery, you know, did that trauma, you know, is it made it harder for people, or do you think that that experience helped in getting you ready for what we're now living?
I think it actually helped, to be honest. I know some people might have felt re-traumatized a little bit, but I think in general it has given our employees in particular, and I think our students also, you know, some sense of resilience. And I think they've proven that they can bounce back and bounce back well. Actually, the year of Hurricane Irma, which I think was in 17-18, was actually a year that this district moved from a B district grade to an A district grade. So that's the kind of effort that was put forth by everyone in the latter half of that year on the heels of the recovery period from Hurricane Irma. So I really think in many ways it's benefited us in terms of developing and certainly testing our resilience, and I think we're seeing some of the benefit of that now.
Let me finish with this. Again, let's come back to the reality here, is that you're retiring, so this is the end for you. You can walk away. But when you look back on your career, you know, what is your greatest legacy?
That's interesting. I'm getting to that point where it's time to maybe have some of those reflections. I think what we have done probably in the greatest sense is we have restored a sense of excellence and pride in the Monroe County schools. And I think you could look at a variety of indicators. There could be financial indicators, student achievement indicators, employee morale indicators, community support indicators. It was a very difficult time in Monroe County when I came in 2012. And I think we've been able, as collectively, and it's a we, it's not an I thing, it's a we thing, that we have really restored, I think, the excellence and pride of the Monroe County schools. And I think anybody who comes into a position of leadership, your number one task is to lead the organization better than you found it. And I think we have accomplished that. So I'll walk away, I think, feeling pretty good about, again, what we have accomplished here in the Monroe County schools in the past 8 years. But I'll also be very concerned about how things continue to move forward. And while I may be walking away from this fall reopening, I will do everything I can to make it as positive and as productive an experience as it can be before I leave.
Monroe County School Superintendent Mark Porter retiring here at the end of this term after 8 years. Sir, congratulations. Best to you as you move forward. And thank you again so much for sharing with us.
Not a problem at all. We appreciate the opportunity.
All right. And you know what? We're going to keep track of what's going on in Monroe County, and we'd love to hear from you if you live down there. Just tell us what, you know, if you're a parent, your thoughts on how schools should reopen in the fall. We'd love to hear what that should look like. Well, still to come, we keep hearing about antibody tests, but what do we know about their accuracy? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Local and statewide officials have said that being exposed to COVID-19 could give you immunity to the virus. Governor Ron DeSantis has said antibody testing could be key in reopening the state, claiming that most people could be immune and probably do not know it.
This is very important, particularly for our first responders and our healthcare workers, to know who has the antibodies. We do believe, I think most people believe, that it will confer a certain level of immunity. They're disagreeing about maybe how long, but I think that that's probably the safest assumption. So the FDA-approved test that Florida has acquired, we have 200,000 and we have more on the way. But what it will do is it will tell people whether they've developed the antibodies within a 15-minute time frame.
All right. Health organizations like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization say it's unknown. It's unknown if the antibodies mean that we're immune. WLRN reporter Jenny Siletovich has been reporting on antibody testing, and she joins us now to discuss. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lewis.
Okay, let's start with this. What is an antibody test?
So an antibody test looks at how your body has responded to an infection. It basically, an antibody is a protein that your body produces to fight off the infection. So the antibody test can look for those proteins.
And what does the antibody test tell us that's different from the diagnostic test? How do those differ?
So the diagnostic test actually looks for the genetic material in the virus. So if you are no longer infected, diagnostic test won't, the genetic material won't be there. So the diagnostic test is the active infection, whereas the antibody test, once you've been infected and you recover, your body can still have those antibodies.
So how does the antibody test work when it's looking for COVID-19?
Well, so they use it because people can have COVID-19 and be asymptomatic. They cannot have symptoms. And so it can tell you if you've had been infected and never realized it because you didn't have symptoms.
How did this testing, the antibody test, become so popular with politicians?
Well, so it came out, at least in Miami-Dade County, the first antibody tests were going to be conducted by Miami-Dade County in conjunction with the University of Miami as part of a survey. It was they wanted to get an idea of how many people might be out there who had been infected and didn't know it. The only people being tested, there was a shortage of the diagnostic tests, and the only people being tested were truly sick. You know, they had symptoms, they were showing up and they were asking for tests. So the antibody test became a way to kind of do a community survey and kind of get a bead on the spread of the disease.
So doctors and researchers say that being infected with COVID-19 does not make you immune like other viruses. How is this virus different?
Well, it's not... It's different in that it's new, and we don't know. We haven't had it around long enough to study the immunity. You know, we don't know if you're going to be immune for a year because we haven't been looking at it for a year. And so the level of immunity is important when it comes to reinfection, and especially these second waves, because suppose it does provide what they call durable immunity, which means it lasts for a long time. You know, we could have, if it's lasting immunity, that gives us time to come up with a vaccine.
Now, you spoke with Dr. Patrice Harris, president of the American Medical Association, recommending not to get the antibody test unless it's overseen by a health professional and if they're participating in a study. Let's listen.
They should not be used by anyone as a determination of whether they are immune or not, or whether or not they can return to work.
Where are we seeing these antibody tests right now being done in Florida, in South Florida?
So the state is actually offering antibody testing at a dozen sites around the state. And then in South Florida, a couple of cities have offered antibody testing to residents and first responders, Aventura, Bal Harbor Village, Bay Harbor Island, Surfside, have teamed up with a medical provider who's providing sort of drive-up antibody testing. The city of Hialeah is offering it to employees. And in Broward County, a handful of cities, including Coral Springs, Parkland, Davie, and Margate, are offering it to city employees who voluntarily want to be tested. But there's sort of a difference in those cities that are offering testing to employees and the drive-up sites where they're offering it to the public. When I talked to Coral Springs and the battalion chief there who's overseeing it and told me about the other cities, they're going to be retesting employees. They are not using it at all to determine who can and cannot return to work. It's they want to look at the spread of the disease in their community and how it ebbs and flows. And so they're going to be testing those employees over every 6 weeks over the next, I guess, through June. because that'll give them more the information they need to determine immunity, you know, like what happens to the levels of antibodies over time. And when I've talked to epidemiologists, they say really the effective use of antibodies is in surveying populations. I mean, it can be a good way to measure how the disease spreads. One thing we haven't talked about, which is the accuracy, and that gets really complicated. It gets into false positives and false negatives. But basically, where the disease is less prevalent, the test is more inaccurate.
We're talking with WLRN reporter Jenny Stiletovich. We're discussing antibody testing for COVID-19, what's known about it, and what questions remain. And you could read Jenny's reporting on social media at WLRN Sundial. Yeah, Jenny, the Food and Drug Administration revised its policy on antibody testing. How so?
Well, so initially, they agreed to issue emergency use authorizations to a lot of different tests because there was such a shortage of diagnostic tests. That was the other reason why antibody testing kind of gained popularity, is because we were coming up short on diagnostic testing. So the antibody testing was sort of a stopgap. That's what Aaron Kobitz at the University of Miami told me about their antibody testing, as a way to kind of, again, like I said, get a pulse on the community and the spread. So they initially lifted some of the guidelines and rules that they normally have in place for testing and providing data on accuracy. After a bunch of tests flooded the market and there were increasing complaints about their accuracy, then the FDA rolled back those guidelines at the beginning of May. And so right now, there are only 12 approved FDA antibody tests. There are still others out there, but the CDC says if you're going to use an antibody test in a clinical setting or for public health, it's got to be one of these FDA approved tests.
And you talked about the University of Miami. They were doing a study on antibody testing. What happened?
Well, so their test was not one of the 12 that were approved. There were four, and then there were 12 approved. Theirs was not one of the 12, so they are now looking to obtain some of those approved tests to continue their study. They say that the testing that they've already done, they will still include that in their research. But going forward, they want to use one of these FDA-approved tests.
So let's come back to politicians. Based on what health professionals like Dr. Anthony Fauci have said about antibody testing, are politicians now getting away from those claims that getting COVID-19 might make you immune?
I mean, I think the word is out. I mean, we've reported it. A lot of other outlets have reported it and clarified that so far antibody testing does not provide information about immunity. I mean, that is just not known yet. It's a question mark. And the CDC makes that very plain on its website, the World Health Organization. So my sense is this idea for immunity passports sort of has come and gone.
Definitely. So South Florida is reopening. What have health professionals told you about the amount of testing that we need to do to avoid a second wave of infections?
Well, so the University of Florida modeled this out earlier this month, and basically in the model they built, they say we need to be able to determine half of the people who are symptomatic and infected. And you've heard a lot about contact tracing. So these two things go hand in hand. The diagnostic testing and contact tracing, an epidemiologist told me, are still the cornerstone for containing the outbreak. So UF's model said if we can identify half those people and then trace 40% of their contacts, then we can keep the number of people quarantined down to 9%. And I'm sorry, I know those are a lot of numbers. But what UF cannot tell us is, those are percentages. UF can't tell us the actual number of tests that need to be done. The State Department of Health has been testing upwards of 16 to 20,000 plus people.
So we don't know. We don't know if that's enough.
Right. That's what that in it. And if there is a second wave, because it's a percentage, that number of testing is going to have to increase. One epidemiologist said exponentially.
At least we got some answers. We're still learning as we go. All right. We've been talking with WLRN reporter Jenny Stiletovich. You can follow all of her reporting on this on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Jenny, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And you can always go to WLRN.org and follow up on everything about this coronavirus. Well, still to come, can restaurants survive at 50% capacity? What did the pandemic do to that industry? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. There are an estimated to be about 16,000 restaurants and bars in South Florida, and they employ tens of thousands of people. This is according to the National Restaurant Association. Restaurants have to remain at 50% capacity, and if any of those restaurants took on loans from the CARES Act, they have to keep everyone on staff. How many of those establishments are surviving or will survive the pandemic? We want to hear from you. If you're an owner or an employee of a restaurant, what do you think is going to happen to this industry? What's happening now as things are starting to reopen? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Well, joining us now is the Miami Herald's food editor and James Beard Award winner, Carlos Frias. Carlos, great to have you back.
It's good to be here, Lewis. Well, here being here and not there.
But. Yes, we are social distancing, and usually we have you on for something so much more entertaining, but a very important conversation. You know, when the pandemic started and the order was to close everything down, what did you start hearing from restaurant owners and chefs about what they thought was going to happen?
I mean, the first thing you heard was layoffs. I mean, restaurants are an industry where stats say that a majority only have about 2 weeks worth of cash on hand to pay, you know, everything from creditors to staff payroll. So immediately some restaurants looked at their bottom numbers and said, if we ever want to hope to come back from this, we have to close our doors. And unfortunately, a lot of folks just got laid off, just got fired.
And do we have any idea? Have you heard of any restaurants that have had to just, well, they went bankrupt. They had to shut down.
Shut down completely. It's a hard thing to kind of gauge right now. A handful have said that they will not reopen, but there were other factors. I think we're going to have to wait to see when everything is back up and running. I mean, that might be a few months to kind of then look at the landscape and see who didn't have the cash on hand to make it back. So that's still an open question.
So back in March, we had a panel conversation with restaurant owners as everything was starting to shut down. And we heard from Matt Kusher, the owner of Kush Hospitality, which includes several restaurants in Miami-Dade. And we asked him what he thought about what reopening would look like.
I just think there's going to be a lot less restaurants in business in 6 months. I think when we reopen, there is going to be a significant amount of restaurants that don't stay open after they reopen. And that's my concern for all the employees that work for those restaurants and for my friends that own those restaurants. And that's the big thing for me. It costs a lot of money to reopen. And when these people reopen, if they're not doing the same numbers that they did before, especially in the summertime, all season in Miami, it's going to be a lot of opportunity for people who want to open restaurants and a lot of bad things for people who own them already.
Now, he's talking about 6 months. So that was 2 months ago. He's talking about 6 months. So, but your response to that?
I think it's too early to tell. It's terrible because what we have is a lot of unknown, right? We don't have any definitive answers yet. There were some surveys done by the James Beard Foundation that said something like 4 to 5 restaurants didn't think that they'd make it close 2 months. And they surveyed, you know, something like 1,600 restaurants across the country. So that's pretty telling. People really looking at their situation and saying, you know, how long can we make it with what we have available? And the answer to them, you know, almost immediately, and even looking ahead a little bit, was not very long.
Has anybody, do you think anybody could have taken advantage of this? Like, I mean, you think about restaurants that, you know, because everything kind of shifted to takeout. So restaurants that already were doing a lot of takeout, or maybe fast food restaurants, they were already positioned to handle this.
Yeah, I would say that places that didn't have a big old dining room and that their business didn't depend on kind of the luxury of service were in the best position to do things. So like there's a little Chinese takeout place on the corner from my house that they literally don't have a dining room. You can go pick up sometimes and it's like you open the door and you reach in and you grab your food. And I think a place like that can continue to do the same kind of business that they were doing before. But for places that had that seated 400 people or 120 people, to then have to continue paying rent for those areas and still trying to make that up with just doing takeout and delivery, it was just not realistic. It made up something like 10 to 25% of their total sales, even after the shift.
One of the interesting things, too, from that panel conversation was there was a concern that would customers want to come back? So Miami-Dade reopened a week ago, and now you're starting to see this week reopenings in Miami and a few other cities. You had the chance to go talk to customers. You walked around as you know, some of these reopenings occurred, and you found customers. And I wondered, what have you heard from them? Like, do they want to go back?
I found everything that ranged from I'm glad to be going back out to dining to I'm not ready to go yet to I went out dining, but please don't tell my family that I went out. That happened at more than one place on more than one day.
Yeah, you had one of your recent stories you found was it three women who were at a restaurant. This was in Kendall, and we saw that restaurants are doing everything they can for social distancing, making sure everything is wiped down and clean and so forth. But there was, some harsh response to those women and the fact that they were out.
Yeah, everything on social media makes it look like the world is ending, right? Like
that's true.
The loudest voices, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? So it's hard to gauge really how far and wide that is. But people have strong, and rightfully so, have strong feelings about this because honestly, nobody wants to get sick, right? That's really what it comes down to is really nobody wants to get sick. And they have strong feelings about the best way to do that. We had a case where, some folks said, please don't use my last name in my story. We had in a separate story doing a separate thing. We had folks who, when they saw we were taking pictures, we'd got approval from the restaurant to photograph inside. A couple folks who moved outside and said, we're out and dining and our family doesn't know we're doing it yet. So, we don't want to be involved in that. And I think it just goes to show that, right? One is, people have varying degrees of comfort with this, and maybe they're saying one thing and doing another. I mean, are we as humans, are we used to doing that? I think the answer is yes.
That is such a fascinating, concept, and how this all plays out is going to be really interesting. We're talking again with the Miami Herald's food editor, James Beard Award winner, Carlos Frias. And if you work in the restaurant business, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the reopening. And I mean, first of all, 2 months, how are you doing? And in this reopening, with restrictions, how is that going to play out? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We did hear from Alex Cook. He's the co-owner of Temple Street Eatery in Fort Lauderdale. He emailed us, and this is what he said. The pandemic has completely changed the way we conduct business, from the basics of customer service to our budget to what the future of the industry will look like. We have had to constantly reevaluate how to do business on every level. Are we confident we'll be open for the next 6 months? I don't know many people in the industry that can answer that. We have made it this far. We are starting to open up and to try to get things back to normal, so we hope we have gone through the trenches and can see a light at the end of the tunnel. As people, things are starting to reopen, what else are you hearing, Carlos, from other restaurant owners and employees about now what? What happens now? There's a lot of restrictions.
Well, one thing that I find really interesting is you have the different municipalities deciding when they're going to allow reopenings, right? So, recently, obviously, county as the said, we're going to open 18th, and then cities get together and say, no, we're not going to open restaurant dining rooms until the 27th. And even when they did, there are thin slices to there. Like, I was just reporting a story that I just filed before I came on where bars that have a license from the state of Florida to sell food, like almost like as a restaurant, basically, like the same kind of license that you would have as a restaurant. In unincorporated parts of the county, those can reopen. A bar, as long as they shut down their physical bar, But within the city of, they passed an ordinance this morning at 5 a.m. that said that if you are, you know, they have other coding restrictions that said that those bars not reopen, you know, after we had heard something different the day before.
All right, so let me start. Hold on real quick, because you're cutting in and out a little bit. So there's it passed today. You're saying in the city of Miami, on restaurants that have bars, and what, there's a new restriction on that? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it was always, they made they called it a clarification. Whereas, if you're a bar, but you have a state license, even if you have a state license, but if you're a bar in the city of Miami and they classify you more as a restaurant, they can't reopen.
And I see.
That caught some people by surprise.
So that gives a lot of bars an opportunity to reopen, because bars are one of those that were not going to reopen.
It would have, but in the city of Miami, it won't. But say on Miami Beach, like where you have, like, say, Sweet Liberty, which is an award-winning bar that has, you know, a restaurant, high restaurant quality food by Michelle Bernstein, that place will reopen. So that's, but it, if you took that place and moved it to the city of Miami, it couldn't reopen. So it goes to show how even within municipalities, we're not sure how we want to handle reopening, you know?
Now, this is an interesting point, because the county, like, as you said, the counties have moved one way, but different cities have made different decisions on that. And so, yeah, Miami-Dade again reopened a week ago, but it's now this week after the Memorial Day holiday that we're seeing cities like Miami, Miami Beach, and others starting to reopen. You know, one of the restrictions, Carlos, as you know, is the 50% capacity. But, you know, we've heard from restaurant owners as well. I know you have. You can't make it on that.
Yeah, and 50% sounds like a lot more than it is, because it's up to 50%. Right. So once you, the key is what the epidemiologist told me that helped craft Miami-Dade's rules, was that the key is the tables inside have to be spaced. People are no closer than 6 feet. Right. So once you do that, depending on the layout, it could be much less than 50% capacity.
Yeah, no. And we talked to the mayor, Carlos Jimenez, about that. Some spaces are very small. We heard from Camila Ramos. She's the owner of All Day in downtown Miami. That's a cafe and restaurant.
Adapting to phase one reopening, we have created an entire outdoor seating dining room, all outside with plants and all of the tables at a 6-foot distance from each other, with hand sanitizer and hand washing stations throughout the dining floor. And we also have limited staff scheduled to reduce crowding. We just want to be able to socialize again at safe distances, outside, and with adequate protection. And it feels like a nice release from the cocoons that we've been in for so long.
Well, it feels like a nice release, but again, this comes back to this idea of the new normal. And so, you know, some restaurants can do that. They can go outside, they have some space outside, and, you know, they can spread things out a little bit, but not everybody can do that. What are some of the other things you're hearing, Carlos, from restaurant owners about how they're going to have to change, whether it's, you know, the way their employees do things, or maybe even physically, they've got to change their restaurant space physically to be able to adapt?
Yeah, I think one thing that you're going to see immediately for folks who are going to venture back out is, you know, there'll be like touchless pay systems. There'll be, instead of bringing you a map to the table, I've seen some restaurants where there's a QR code. Have you ever seen those? It looks like kind of a barcode.
Yes.
And you just kind of you just turn on your phone and you turn on your camera, and just when the camera sees it, it takes you to a website that has their menu. I'm seeing that actually a lot. So basically, folks, you don't have to touch any menus. You can pay, you know, completely through your phone using those QR code systems. I've seen that. Lots of plexiglass, you know. And then you also think about the smaller restaurants, right? The ones that don't have the money to invest in this kind of technology. And I'm really curious to see how those guys are going to fare, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing, too, is just I'm thinking about some of the stuff that might disappear. I wonder, too, like buffets. A buffet can't. How could that survive?
No. Yeah. Buffets are canceled. I wrote that a couple weeks ago. You know, because what they've told us about the virus is this is something that lingers in the air, and the more things are exposed, more time that you're exposed to it, it's kind of like snowfall. Like I've pictured it like snowfall. Like you have to keep dusting your shoulders off with it, you know? And I just can't imagine a place where big vats of food are left open and you go in, or, and even someone serving you, you know? I think even their model is going to change. I talked to several, you know, popular South Florida buffets. Well, this was their bread and butter, and they were already planning to reopen as traditional restaurants.
So many things are changing. It is good to see things reopen, but again, what is the industry going to look like in the coming months? You can follow a lot of this. Again, Miami Herald food editor Carlos Frias, you can follow a lot of this. He's doing some great reporting. Check out some of his stuff on our Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Carlos, thanks again. Always appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Lewis.
All right. Take care. Stay safe. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, May 27th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, Congresswoman Debbie McCarcel-Powell recently visited the Crystal Health Rehabilitation Center in the Florida Keys, where multiple people have died of the virus. Powell tested negative for the virus herself. We're going to learn about protections for nursing homes, and we'll take your questions. Plus, a new podcast from Slate explores some of the companies that are prevalent in the news for good and bad reasons. Thrilling Tales of Modern Capitalism's first episode is about a company here in Miami, Carnival Cruises. And finally, masks have become the new social norm. The Boca Raton Museum of Art has an ongoing exhibition that looks at the history and culture of masks around the globe. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. Remember, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the program. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Lewis Hernandez. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.